The Buffalo Bills posted their largest margin of victory in a shutout since 1966 as they stomped the Dolphins 35-0 in Miami.
Now the snap. The give goes to Motor Singletary. Big hole up the middle. Finds room. He's at the 30. 25, 20, 15, 10, 5. Touchdown! Devin Singletary motors into the end zone. Touchdown, Buffalo. A 46-yard touchdown run on the second play from scrimmage.
When given the opportunity, they were affecting the quarterback early, and I like that. I mean, just in terms of what they were doing, I thought Leslie called an aggressive game and did a nice job letting those guys go, too, and with a four-man rush once in a while. So, you know, as I always say, the rush and the coverage have to work together, and I thought the back end was doing their part also.
Josh Allen went 17 of 33 for 179 yards, two touchdowns and an interception. Stephon Diggs led the air attack with 60 yards and a score, while Devin Singletary and Zach Moss paced the ground game with over 100 combined yards and three touchdowns. The Bills are now 1-1 and prepare for a home date with the Washington football team at 1 p.m. next Sunday. Full play-by-play right here on the Bills Radio Network.
Can you feel it? The power of the Bills. Can you feel it? The thunder and the thrills. We've got the drive and the attitude. If you're big on the thrills, we're the Buffalo.
Welcome to Bills Mafia Talk, as it's all things Buffalo Bills, and the Bills coming into week three are 1-1. Each week, we will talk to somebody from the Buffalo Bills Radio Network or another NFL personality, pundit, talking head. We'll get their thoughts on the Buffalo Bills, and then we'll get somebody from the opposing side, the opposing media, and get their thoughts on their team that they cover and their thoughts on the Buffalo Bills from a different perspective. To be part of the show, you can call and leave a voice message or text 607-252-4BMT. That's 607-252-4BMT. That's for Bills Mafia Talk. That's 252-4268. Well, the Bills certainly bounced back down in South Beach after that tough loss at home against the Pittsburgh Steelers, squishing the fish and beating the Heat 35-0. And let's bring on our first guest, Nate Geary. He is the host of the Bills Radio Network pregame show, Countdown to Kickoff, Bills Game Day. He is also the host of the halftime show, and he's the host of the overtime show. He also does work for WGR 550 during the week and on the weekends. Nate, thanks so much for coming on. And you kick everything off on the Bills Radio Network, and then you finish it up with the overtime show. So you start it and end it. How long on a given Bills Sunday do you work for GR and the Buffalo Bills Radio Network?
It is a traditional 1 o'clock game. I am there the full 12, so I'm there 8 a.m., 8 p.m. I usually get to the stadium for home games around 7:15, 7:30, settle in, have my morning coffee, you know, go over morning notes, so on and so forth. Take my, you have to take a selfie while you're in the broadcast booth. That's sacrilegious. So yeah, it's a pretty long day. The primetime games are really what mess up my schedule, because I'll be, at the station until, sometimes I'm there till 2-3 a.m.
So for those who have not caught you on the network, you kick things off a couple hours before the game, you and the crew.
Yeah, so I co-host Buffalo Bills Game Day with morning show host Jeremy White, and then myself and my other co-host for Countdown to Kickoff, Joe DiBiase, who's also on the Extra Point Show during the week on WGR and is the host of the Nightcap and also the afternoon show producer. So he has a whole bunch of stuff going on, that Joe DiBiase. But yeah, no, for pregame, I sort of start off at 8, co-host that show, and then I'm the main co-host on Countdown to Kickoff. Been doing that for, this is season 3 now, for those counting at home, which is kind of crazy.
That is. Time flies, especially when you're having fun and the Bills are winning. So then at the end, you wrap everything up by taking calls from Bills Mafia and put a cap on everything?
Yeah, so I'm kind of the nightcap for Sunday nights, right before we kind of kick things over to Westwood and do Monday Night Football. So, Sunday Night Football. So, it's pretty fun. I'm not going to lie. I have a lot of fun on that evening show. I don't, it's one of those things that sometimes you take for granted after a game, but I always enjoy listening to what the folks have to say, even if it's not always the smartest thing.
Right. Well, let me ask you this.
Liberally.
Well, the Bills are on an upswing. not that this is a bad thing because you love what you do, but you got to work a little harder now trying to find things to talk about. It's a lot easier, you know, when the Bills lose 35-0 to find things to talk about and break down and second guess. But when they're winning 35-0, it becomes a little harder. My wife was like, well, what are you going to talk about? They won so convincingly. Well, if that was the case, they wouldn't have two extremely popular sports talk radio stations in Boston, because the Patriots over the last 20 years have been extraordinarily successful and haven't played a ton of close games, and they still nitpick the Patriots to no end. So it makes you maybe dive a little deeper. Did you have trouble finding things that you wanted to talk about that maybe you weren't really happy with in this game?
Well, I'll tell you, everybody wanted to talk about Josh Allen, even though the offense scored 35 points, right? So I think sometimes, listen, I've been sort of preaching this from, you know, wherever anyone will give me a place to preach it from. But essentially, my bid to everyone was to try to enjoy this season and the ups and downs of the regular season, because you just never know what happens when you get to the playoffs. And as coaches love to say, one of the coach speak things is just get to the tournament, right? And anything can sort of happen when you get to the playoffs. And I think last year proved that, right? I mean, a pretty crazy play. You go to that AFC divisional game, you have two missed field goals from the most accurate kicker of all time, and a pick six in the red zone by Taron Johnson, who's now like one of the best players in this team's defense. So, yeah, everybody sort of wants to talk about the quarterback and wants to talk about the negatives from a 35-0 win. And I think it tells you just a bit about how far I think this fan base has come from a confidence and expectation and the standard standpoint.
So let me ask you about the offense. Well, because the defense on Sunday against the Dolphins played so well, I think it made the offense look even better. I mean, they really set the offense up, and it just kind of set the tone. And I don't think the offense needed to really do that much to even win that game. And, you know, the book on Josh and the complaint was after his first year or so was he's not accurate enough. And can he throw the deep ball with high accuracy? And he's maybe running too much and he's not staying in the pocket. Then last year, his completion percentage goes way up. His QB rating jumps. Daboll is praised for his play calling. He's a hot assistant for head coaching jobs. And then in the offseason, it was, well, can Allen keep that up, or can he take a step forward, or is he going to regress to the 2019 Josh Allen? So there seems to be even more pressure because it's such a quarterback-driven league, Nate, that people now have more expectations on Josh to make the next step than they did the last step.
Yeah, and listen, I think expectations should go up when, you know, you've been given a $258 million contract. You won't find me, you know, suggesting that he should be held to the same standard he was his rookie season or in 2019 or in 2020 for that matter. But I think people should do a better job of trying to enjoy the now of this whole thing, because this season is going to be special. Well, it's the buildup is going to be special. And I think we can get sort of lost in hyper analyzing a week in and week out performance from a quarterback that, listen, is fun. He plays the game the right way. He plays a game that I think is incredibly entertaining. So at times there are, and the thing that I've been preaching over the last two postgame shows is that we've seen games like this from Allen last year. He went through two or three game stretches where it wasn't as good as the ceiling and this is the floor. And we see peaks and valleys with Allen. And I think everyone needs to relax a little bit and let's see them play against a secondary that isn't as good as the ones that we've faced over the last 2 weeks, particularly last week against the Dolphins, who, you know, gave up 35 points, but that's one of the best secondaries in the league. And not a lot of quarterbacks have as much success. In fact, almost no other quarterbacks have as much consistent success against the Miami Dolphins secondary that features, you know, one All-Pro and one Pro Bowler and two of the top five highest paid corners in the league. So that there are no slouches on that other side of the ball. And I think they did a pretty good job all afternoon, though. You know, Xavier Howard's interception was it's a pretty damn good play from Xavier Howard. And then, you know, Byron Jones made several good plays, a couple of pass breakups as well, that were just good plays. So sometimes you as NFL guys and coaches would say, you know, those guys get paid too. And I think we saw that last week against the Dolphins. I think there's a lot to want from Josh's game. And here's the good part is I think he'd be the first to tell you that, like, hey, I need to play better And he's going to be the type of guy that hyper-analyzes what it is going wrong and try to correct it here the next couple of weeks, which are going to be against far more forgiving defenses.
Well, let's talk about one thing that some of the naysayers and critics are talking about with Josh Allen. And I'm a stats guy. I love looking up stats. I love finding stats. I think it does tell you a story. I don't think it's everything. I think some of it is the eye test. You can't just look at stuff on paper, but I certainly think it gives you a good indicator and points you in the right direction of what's working and what's not. But the stats, I'll be honest, I'm an old guy. The stats have gone next gen on me. Like, I don't even know what some of the acronyms mean, let alone how to interpret the numbers. But I did see this. When the Bills had a 4 or 5 wide receiver set on Sunday against the Steelers, they only averaged 3.4 yards per play. And normally in those formations, you're looking for a lot more yards per play. It almost seemed like the Steelers were waiting and anticipating that. And also, they played over 75% did the Steelers zone defense. And going back to the beginning of the 2020 season, when Josh goes up against a team that plays 70% zone, he's 3-3. So it seems like defensive coordinators are starting to pick up some things.
Yeah, listen, it's a reaction from the league, right? It's a way for the league to try to slow down one of the highest, you know, and maybe most efficient passing offenses last year against man and against the blitz. The thing was, you know, that I think it's important to remember is you rewind to 2019, you know, the sort of knock against Josh Allen then was, well, he can't beat man coverage. And you think about that Baltimore Ravens game that they lose at the end of the, one of the big things that defenses, it's all a part of this evolution, right? Where if it's sort of evolve or die, or change or die, adapt or die. And I think the Bills right now are being faced with a pivot point, right? Like 2 years ago, it was against man coverage. Then they sort of got that monkey off their back. This is the way of the NFL sort of pivoting themselves and saying, we're not going to run a lot of man coverage. We're not going to run a lot of cover zero blitz against you because you burn us. So this is their sort of their adaption to what Josh Allen was doing really well last year, and give the Bills a couple of weeks here, and I think you're going to see their answer in this sort of chess game that they're playing with the rest of the league and the defense is how they're trying to defend Josh.
It's Bills Mafia Talk. To leave a voice message or send us a text, it's 607-252-4BMT. That's 252-4BMT. We threw that out on Twitter. You can call, leave a voice message, or send us a text if you have a question. On the phone with us, Nate Geary, part of the Buffalo Bills Radio Network. He gets things going with the pregame show. He hosts a halftime show. Then he hosts the overtime show. Nate, go ahead and throw out that Twitter handle of yours. You're a great follow on Twitter.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Nate Geary Sports. Last name is G-E-A-R-Y.
So because the NFL, unlike Major League Baseball and the NBA, is a sprint and not a marathon, it's such a reactionary overreaction one way or the other sort of league. After that Pittsburgh loss, you know, and maybe the game against the Dolphins will quell some of this, but I think a lot of people are saying, well, the offense didn't really play that well. The defense played so well. The offense looked better than they really were against Miami. The talk, and it wasn't that people were suggesting this should happen, but there was some rumblings that maybe McDermott steps in or changes things up on the offensive side of the ball and becomes more involved in the play calling, like he did a couple years ago with Leslie Frazier on the defensive side. Now, McDermott is a defensive guy, so maybe he feels a little bit more comfortable doing that on the defensive side of the ball, but that seemed to be something some people were throwing out, at least after the Pittsburgh game. Maybe that'll quiet down now.
I think for the most part, I don't know that there's real viability to that happening. I think it was brought up as a sort of solution to the issues that we saw in week one. And we did see that in the inverse. We did see Sean McDermott take over play calling duties from one of his longest standing friends and a guy that he really is in a laboratory with every day. It's a little different on the offensive side of the ball. Sean McDermott's not going to take over and start calling plays. And, you know, are you going to turn things over? Because I think, as an expression that my grandfather used to say, the crap would be out of the donkey. You can't really take back giving play calling duties away or taking the passing offense play calling duties and sending them to, you know, Ken Dorsey, right? Like, you can't really go back on doing that. Sure. So I think you would have to be in a really tight spot. You'd have to really be you know, down on this offense. And it'd have to be several weeks. They'd have to be, you know, 2-5, and you're looking for a reboot. Like, that to me is the only way that happens. So for me, I think it quiets any conversations we were having about it. I still think there are plenty of questions of how they can be more efficient, how they can be better. We had been asking for a while, how can they be more efficient running the football? How can they at least present a threat to the defense? And I think they answered that question this week, that's for sure.
So you brought up Ken Dorsey's name. He is the quarterback coach, and he's the passing game coordinator, whatever that means. And that brings us to one of the texts we got when we threw that out. What people may want to have us ask you is, what is Ken Dorsey's role? Because Brian Daboll has gotten so much love as a play caller and his development of Josh Allen. Now you hear a lot about Ken Dorsey, and maybe he was a big part of that. What is Ken's role in the offense and play call? It just seems like maybe, and especially if Sean's going to get involved in calling plays as well, a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah, listen, Ken Dorsey is your primary communicator from Josh Allen to Brian Daboll. He's on the sidelines where Dable's up in the booth, right? So Ken Dorsey sort of has like the day-to-day interactions on the field, the play-to-play interactions, I should say, with Josh Allen on the field. And listen, I think it's a fair question to ask and want to know, like, hey, what does he bring to the table? Should that be something that we explore? And I think that the Bills are in a really good spot with Ken Dorsey as their you know, their quarterback's coach. I'm a little surprised myself that he didn't maybe see some more love this offseason as other head coaches moved to new situations and were looking for coordinators. And I think his time as an offensive play caller and coordinator will come. And I do believe Brian Daboll will be in line this offseason or be a favorite at least somewhere for a head coaching position, which would line, you know, Ken Dorsey to sort of take over and be the heir apparent there. So I think the Bills are in a really good, comfortable position with who he is and where he sort of fits in with the organization. But as of right now, you know, his main job is to work on and continue the growth and success of Josh Allen.
On the phone with us, it's Nate Geary. He is the host of the Buffalo Bills Countdown to Kickoff and Game Day on the Bills Radio Network. He also hosts the Halftime Show and the Overtime Show. He is on Twitter at Nate Geary Sports. Great follow. I highly suggest you follow him if you are part of Bills Mafia here in the Southern Tier. Another question we got by a very observant Bills Mafia member that they wanted me to ask you is that Dawson Knox was on the field for more than 80% of the offensive snaps. And they said, you know, they like Dawson Knox, but why was he out there so much and Gabriel Davis was not utilized or not seen as much?
So I'll tell you, it was their response to getting burned bad last week against 3- and 4-man rushes. So essentially their response to 3- and 4-man rushes and basically having their offensive linemen lose one-on-one battles was to bring Dawson Knox instead of going 10 personnel with 4 and 5 wide receivers. I think Joe Biscaglia of The Athletic said last week they ran 4 and 5 wide receiver sets 60% of the time. And I think they reduced that down this week to just over 20% or somewhere near 20%. So there was a very concerted effort to change and give Josh Allen, but give the offensive line an additional 6-man and those 6-man protections instead of 5-man protections. We were leaving a lot of guys on islands. And I think it worked. It worked in the run game in particular. And if teams are going to run 2 high safeties on the Bills, which is what they are seemingly doing, bringing that tight end into the box can create mismatches. You're going to get him lined up against middle linebackers. You're going to get him lined up against other teams inside and outside linebackers. So I think that's a good matchup for the Bills, and he provides an extra blocker in the run game. And I think it's part of the reason you saw this Bills run game take off. It's much harder to run out of 4 and 5 wide sets if the offensive line isn't winning their one-on-one battles.
We didn't see him much on Sunday, but I did want to get your thoughts on Tua. The Dolphins pushed all their chips in. They thought he'd be a franchise quarterback, still looking for one since Dan Marino. I'm not sure about him. He seems injury prone, and I he seems like a middle of the road type of quarterback. I just don't see him becoming an elite quarterback. Do you?
I don't. I think Tua can be a average. I think Tua could probably be Jared Goff with the right coach. You know, a guy that could, you know, with if everything was perfect around him and he had a young or ingenious play caller that could guide him through. But Tua really struggles to get off his first read. In college, he was never asked or never tasked with having to read a defense, go through 2, 3, and 4, make a decision, move and progress in the pocket and deliver accurate throws. He was always sort of awarded the ability to throw to his first read. And the Bills took away his first read on Sunday in those first two drives, and he seemed absolutely puzzled. And it's a trend that when you turn on the film, that's what you see with Tua. And he's not a guy, I think his passer rating is in the 60s when he holds onto the football more than 2.5 seconds. His passer rating is like 110 when he gets rid of the ball in under 2.5 seconds. And that works sometimes, but if teams take away your number one read and you can't progress onto the second and third option in the NFL, you're not going to last long in this league. And you saw sort of that hesitation got him killed in that football game.
Talking about Alabama players, clearly the Crimson Tide has dominated college football since Saban went to Bama. A lot of guys going number one or in the top five. The book is still out on Jalen Hurts, Tua, Mac Jones, AJ McCarron, Greg McElroy at the quarterback position did not pan out. At the running back position, Henry looks like he's panned out, but there's been other great running backs at the college level at Alabama that have not really produced much in the NFL. And I've talked to a lot of people that say it's hard to evaluate the Alabama players because there's so many good players on that Alabama team. There's such a wagon that you don't know if that player is really that good or it's just that Alabama as a team is that good.
I think it's a fair question to ask, right? I mean, I believe that it's very hard to assess Alabama players in general, particularly on the offensive side of the ball, because they're large humans. They get worked in practice. They play a lot. There's a lot of wear and tear on those players. And I think for me, I think it was really hard to evaluate Tua. The reason I think it was so difficult is he's throwing to multiple first-round picks, a Heisman Trophy winner that are creating 4, 5, 6 yards of separation with inferior speed and inferior talent. You know, what are you going to learn about Tua against Murray State?
Right.
You know, you're not going to learn a lot. And even against Georgia and even against some of these higher-end SEC teams and teams in Clemson, you know, that they play, I found that in those games, you saw Tua get exposed a little bit, and you saw the Mac Joneses of the world get exposed. But the difference with Mac Jones is I believe he can get off of his first read, and he has shown early on in his career in preseason and through the first two games of the season that he can get through a progression and make and deliver throws and be sort of a facilitator. And Tua has not. And when you have to design an offense that's predicated around, you know, eye candy and doing a lot of RPO where it's either run pass option, you're not setting up a full field read in run pass option. You know, your offensive linemen have to be able to move downfield. You have to make a decision under 2 seconds on whether or not it's a pass or run. So that offense is not designed for him to read the field. And until they create an offense that's a little bit more modern, he's going to be incredibly one-dimensional and easy to defend, especially with that offensive line. That was one of the worst offensive line performances I've ever seen.
That was a sieve, that is for sure. No doubt about that. I know it's still early in the week, but what does the injury report look like coming out of that Miami game?
Yeah, from what I heard from Sal Capaccio this morning on the Extra Point Show on WGR, he pointed to both Tremaine Edmonds and Levi Wallace, who did not play much in the second half. Both guys were dealing with some cramping, getting IVs, and they just essentially didn't go back in the game because they were up 35-0. So, and they were up by multiple scores in that second half. So they it gave them an opportunity to get some depth players, some reps, and get them in the game and put Tremaine and put Levi Wallace, guys they're going to really rely on a long season, an extra game this year. I think you can expect to see that more if the Bills get up early in football games. And even if they don't, I think you're going to see opportunities for some of these depth players to get some meaningful snaps. It's what they're doing at the defensive end position. I think it's why you're seeing Mario Addison play and look really fresh and be very effective this year, because he and Jerry Hughes are going to be afforded far more sideline reps, where they're, you know, on the sideline, they're not having to play 40, 50 snaps a game. And I think it's going to give them more meaningful and valuable downs when they're needed towards the end of the season.
Before we turn our attention to the Washington football team, give me one or two ups and one or two downs from a player standpoint.
I think you got to look directly at AJ Epenesa. I mean, what a performance. 9 pressures in one football game. He looked, and I mentioned this today, I mean, he just looks unrecognizable. If you turn on the Iowa film his last year, it's just an unrecognizable player. I mean, he's quicker. He's got bend. You know, he's got a pass rush plan when he gets to the line of scrimmage. And he made both tackles look like chumps on Sunday. That was as impressive a performance as I've seen in a long time from a Bills pass rusher. The other guy I think is on and up here, too, is Taron Johnson, who is arguably pound for pound the best player in this defense right now. And his progression, his development is going to be huge. And every year you go into a season, you have to develop a new player. You can't just remain the same. And his progression from basically losing his job to undrafted free agent Cam Lewis last year to one of the best nickel and slot defenders in the league, both as a run and pass defender, has been really great. And their return on investment for him from Murray State has been really unbelievable. He's sort of on that same level as Matt Milano. I think he's going to get paid this offseason. It's a premier position at slot corner. Some of the downs. You know, I'm obviously going to look at this Bills passing offense in particular. Josh Allen's completion percentage, second game in a row under 60% completion percentage. He had two games all of 2020 with lower than 60% completion percentage. And through the first two games, he's already met that total in 2021. So I'm looking for that passing offense to really take some strides over the next couple of weeks against inferior pass defenses. Even though Washington's got a really great front seven, a really good defensive line, one of the best young players, edge rushers in the league, and Chase Young, I do believe that they're vulnerable in the back end, and there's some things you can get done in the passing game per Daniel Jones last week on primetime was a pretty prime example of that. And I think the other down from that football game as well continues to be the punt game and Matthew Hawk. I have not been really impressed by their move from Corey Bohorquez to Matt Hawk. He just really has not shown up in a game situation and warranted them punting the ball. You know, and fourth and short, I still think this offense, as long as they're not pinned back in their own territory, should be going for it. You know, you talked about being a numbers guy, me too. The numbers suggest on fourth and short, fourth and two, fourth and one, you really should be going for it any opportunity outside of your own 40-yard line.
So there won't be another Fitzmagic return to Orchard Park, at least with him under center. Fitzpatrick has a hip injury. He won't have surgery, but he's rehabbing it. So it'll be Taylor Heinicke under center for the Washington football team. And at this point in both of their careers, is one better than the other, do you think?
I think they're pretty similar at this point in each of their careers. I'm not sure that you're really getting better play out of one guy or the other. I think Heinicke's a little streakier at this point. He's a little younger and a little bit more mobile, a guy that can move around. I liked some of the things he did last week against the Giants, and I do think the Giants are one of the better top 15 defenses in the league. They put a lot of resources on that side of the ball. They've got a pretty good defensive backfield, the Dory Jackson and James Bradbury, who's really one of the better corners in the league. So, I think that they did pretty well, all things considered, last week. I will tell me for Washington, that defense, you know, as good as they are up front, I think four first round picks. Jonathan Allen is a stud in the interior. They've got Chase Young, obviously, and Josh Sweat. So I'm sorry, not Josh Sweat. Who's their other Josh Sweat?
It's Montez Sweat.
Sweat. Okay, so it was a Sweat. I just wasn't Josh Sweat. Josh Sweat is in Philadelphia. Montez Sweat, Jonathan Allen, Darren Payne, and Chase Young really, really round out one of the better, more talented, younger defensive lines in the league. I do like Landon Collins a lot on the back end. Kendall Fuller is a really solid player as well. William Jackson is obviously, I think, pretty susceptible and can be beaten. So I do think that the Bills have an opportunity against this defense to do some things, get their passing game on track. But offensively, yeah, I like some of the weapons they have. I think Terry McLaurin's one of the best young receivers in the league. Their offensive line's okay. It doesn't get them killed. And Logan Thomas is a really nice player. So I Heinicke, Fitzpatrick, I think you're getting pretty much the same thing. And it's the two running backs that I think in Antonio Gibson and J.D. McKissic that really present some problems for this Bills defense. But I've been really pleasantly surprised with how good this Bills defense has looked early on in this football season. And they're not getting a huge step up in test here in terms of competence offensive-wise. But I do think I don't want to come off too hot takey, but I think at this point I've liked what I've seen more from Taylor Heinicke than I have from Tua Tagovailoa. So you know, I think he'll present a little bit more of a matchup disruption than Tua did last week.
All right, can I get a score prediction for Sunday, Washington at Buffalo?
I like the Bills in this matchup. I like them to bounce back offensively in terms of passing game. I like them to score, you know, between 28 and 31 points. And I think they end up winning like 28-17, 28-20 over Washington at home to get back above 500 and, you know, sort of back in the driver's seat in both the AFC East and the AFC at large, which a big win, obviously, for the Baltimore Ravens on Sunday night, at least for the Bills. I was a little worried they weren't going to be able to make up for that loss early to Pittsburgh, an AFC loss. It's a conference loss, and you were already going to be one game behind Kansas City, and I don't know that you could really afford to do that throughout. So that was a big win to sort of get them back to 500 and back on an even playing field in terms of, you know, the race for the top seed in the AFC with the Bills.
Now, last year, my guess is you did the pre and the half and the post game remotely. You're back in person now?
Yeah, I did a lot of stuff remote last year. And then obviously last football season, I was just at the station the entire time. So that this year, I was actually in week one, I was actually live in person for my first football game in over 5 years. I was a season ticket holder from 16 when my dad, for my 16th birthday, gave me season tickets until age 24 when I really started to kind of get more involved in Bill's pregame and stuff at WGR. So it's been a while since I'd been to a game, and it was really great to see. The atmosphere was unbelievable. It's great to sort of be back and be live and see people again. The atmosphere in that stadium was unlike any sporting event short of the 2006 playoffs. I believe it was 2006 playoff game where Chris Drury scores the game tying goal with whatever many seconds left. The Sabres ended up beating the Rangers in the playoffs. That was the only live sporting event that featured a louder, rowdier, and memorable moment for me.
I don't think it's going to be extremely cold on Sunday, and that is a big home field advantage for the Buffalo Bills. But do you like when the Bills go down and play in Miami in September rather than December or January? It was a steamer. It was like 90, felt like 100 down on the field. But then some others say it's hard to be up here in the winter and then have to go down there and deal with the heat. But on the other hand, you'd like the Dolphins to have to come to Buffalo in December or January rather than September or October.
I think it's to play in that humidity in the middle of summer, that's a tough task for anybody. So, I think overall, getting them later in the year here, just like that's an advantage for the Bills. I do believe being down there in September is an advantage for the Dolphins, although you wouldn't have noticed it if you watched that game Sunday.
Nate, great job as always. We'll talk to you down the road and we'll hear you on Sunday.
Absolutely. Anytime you need me, my phone's always on.
All right, there you go. Nate Geary. You can follow him on Twitter at Nate Geary Sports. That's G-E-A-R-Y. He is the host of the Bills Countdown to Kickoff and Game Day pregame show. He's host of the Halftime and the Overtime show on the Bills Radio Network. You'll hear him on Sunday when the Bills host the Washington football team. Pregame at 11, kickoff at 1. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll have an expert on to talk about the Washington football team. It's Bills Mafia Talk.
You're listening to Bills Mafia Talk.
Welcome back, and the Buffalo Bills will take on the Washington football team this Sunday. Pre-game at 11, kickoff at 1. These two teams have only played 15 games going back to 1972. The Bills lead the all-time series 9-6. They've won 7 out of the last 8 matchups. The last time these two teams met was in Orchard Park on the 3rd of November 2019, with the Bills victorious 24-9. The last time the Bills lost to the Washington football team was in 2015. The Bills were in the nation's capital, losing 35-25. At home against Washington, the Bills are 6-2. And, you know, I know sometimes playing the Washington football team is a little bit of a trigger for Bills Mafia. You know, they have flashbacks of that 1992 Super Bowl. I think that was in Minnesota. I think that was the game Thurman couldn't find his helmet. I think Kelly threw for like a million yards, but he had a bunch of interceptions, and they had to throw a ton to kind of get back into the game. And, you know, my son couldn't believe when I said I was a Washington fan growing up, because pretty much his entire life, Washington has been a dumpster fire and pretty bad. They may have made it to the playoffs once since he's been born in 18 years ago. So he was surprised, but, you know, I tried to tell him, you know, remember, well, not remember because he wasn't alive, but you got to know that in the 80s, in the 90s, the Redskins were a powerhouse. I loved Coach Joe Gibbs. I loved Theismann, Rippon, Schroeder, Williams, John Riggins, the Diesel, all of those hog mollies up front, Joe Jacoby, Russ Grimm, Jeff Bostic, Mark May, Brian Mitchell. Speaking of Brian Mitchell, he is the host of B. Mitch and Finley on 106.7 FM, The Fan, WJFK in Washington, D.C. He is also the Washington football beat writer for NBC Sports Washington, and he is the host of the Washington Football Podcast. It's J.P. Finley. J.P., thanks so much for joining us.
No problem, man. Thank you for having me.
So Washington wins a thriller on Monday night over the Giants at the buzzer with a field goal. If I told you in the preseason after 2 weeks, Washington would be 1-1, would you be shocked? Would you be happy? Would you be disappointed?
Definitely not surprised. I'm not sure about happy either. I mean, I think 2-0, you're happy. I think 1-1 is kind of what I expected. I didn't know which game they'd win just because the Giants had had their number. The Giants had won 5 in a row. But I thought, basically, I looked at the first month of the first 4 games of the season that they have to get through it 2-2. And I think that's entirely still possible. I think winning, for them to win in Buffalo is going to be a really tall order. But they got Atlanta after that. I think they should win that. And really, Washington's schedule is so weird. I've never seen anything like it. Their last 5 games of the season are all divisional games. Washington fans, you just got to tread water. You got to get to December at 5-6 or 6-5, and your season's right there in front of you.
On the phone with us, J.P. Finley. He is the co-host of B. Mitch and Finley, 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. on 106.7 The Fan in D.C. He also hosts the Washington Football Podcast. You've been covering this football team for a while. Go ahead and give us a little bit of background on you.
Sure. You know, I'm a D.C. native. I remember that Super Bowl you were talking about in 91. I was a kid. I was 9 years old. I think that team kind of set me on the course of doing this professionally just because I was so obsessed with them. I've been out here covering this team 10 years, kind of the beginning of the RG3 era and the Shanahan era prior to that. And, you know, work for NBC, do the podcast, do the radio show, like you mentioned.
Great follow on Twitter. I believe, is it J.P. Finley NBCS? Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Thank you for pronouncing it right.
So let me get you. So you do a weekly spot, am I correct, with Ron during the season? Is that right?
Yeah, sure do.
So I know your co-host this week was not extremely happy with some of the remarks from Coach Rivera about some of the fundamentals and how they've been playing through 2 weeks. Brian really felt these were things that should have been addressed in the preseason and not being talked about going into week 3. You talk to Ron each week. You get to know him a little bit. Do you find it difficult or awkward to talk to him and then go on the radio and go on TV and go on the internet and have to be critical of him and point out things that he didn't do or did do that he shouldn't have done? Does that ever create any awkwardness between you guys when you do your weekly spot?
Nah, I mean, he's a pro, dude. I covered Bruce Allen for 10 years. Like, you got to be critical. And Bruce and I didn't see eye to eye on much, but unless you make it personal, I mean, my job is to talk about the game. If the game sucks, those guys know what's coming.
Sure.
That stuff's not really an issue.
So during your time covering the team, you've seen a lot of front office changes. You've seen head coaches come and go. Ron Rivera comes in. He led Carolina to a Super Bowl appearance, 15-1. He got the Redskins, as ugly as it was, to a playoff appearance last year, even with a losing record. Do you believe Rivera is the coach to finally get this Washington football team back to where they want to be?
I certainly think this is the best situation in a long time in Washington. I mean, there's one constant throughout Washington's struggles over the last 25 years, and that's ownership. Ownership's not going to change, period. But I do think the best thing right now is that Ron is the boss of all things football. And, you know, Herney and Mayhew have big titles, but Ron is their boss. And as bad as things have been in Washington, there was always kind of this conduit between ownership and football. And for 10 years, that was Bruce Allen. For 10 years, that was Vinny Serrato. And that person was a real detriment to the team, both of those people. And now Ron gets to go direct to Dan himself and ideally maybe control some of the whims of a owner that has put his thumbprint far too much on the organization. But that can always change, man. Like, you know, if Ron has 2 bad years, is Dan going to continue to allow him to run the show? I don't know. So I believe this is the best situation there's been in the Snyder ownership era, except for maybe when Joe Gibbs was here for his second stint. But things change quick with the Washington football team.
Well, the Washington football team has been in the headlines the last few years, probably not for the right reasons. So the owner, Dan Snyder, he finally relented and gave in with the mascot. He was under heat for many years over the Washington Redskins mascot. He said he'd never give in and fold on that. He finally did after a lot of pressure. Then there was these allegations and stories a year or so ago with some harassment in the front office with the play-by-play guy. They made changes with the broadcast team. They brought a woman into the broadcast team on the Redskins radio network. They've diversified in the front office. Did you ever think, because you're in Washington, D.C., so you see a lot of scandals, you see a lot of guys in hot water. Some guys do the duck and cover. Let me just hunker down and the storm will pass. The media cycle will go to somebody else who's been bad and that the media wants to cancel, and then I can pop my head back up and everything will be okay. Other guys don't want anything else to be brought to light. So right away, they wave the white flag. You win. I'm done. I'm sorry. And I'll never do it again. And they go away. After that Post story, the NFL did some investigation, really didn't seem to find a whole heck of a lot. Did you ever think Dan Snyder would sell the team or would be forced to get rid of the team?
No, never. Period. Never happened.
So he was going to ride it out no matter what. He was in for the...
I mean, unless the NFL was going to force it, which they never even showed a hint of that.
Right.
Now, I mean, was I surprised that the NFL allowed them to lift the debt ceiling and let him buy out the other partners and all that stuff? Yeah, I was surprised by that. But in no uncertain terms, I was told firmly throughout that he's not selling. I never thought it would happen. I was told it would never happen. I don't believe it will ever happen. I think that team will go to his kids.
Dan kind of reminds me of Jerry Jones in Dallas. Jerry was very successful in the beginning with Jimmy Johnson. They butted heads. He's not been real successful since. Yes, they won that Super Bowl with Barry Switzer right after Jimmy left, but that was a rollover from Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy and Jerry butted heads. They were two strong personalities, and, you know, Jimmy won out some, and then eventually Jimmy left. Dallas has not been very good since then. A lot of people believe that Jerry is too involved. Do you believe Dan Snyder is still as involved as he once was? Because it seems like Ron Rivera has been given a lot of power.
Who knows, dude? I tend to doubt it, but officially they'll tell you that.
Okay. Gotcha. So Western New York is certainly familiar with Ryan Fitzpatrick, Fitzmagic. He spent 4 years in Buffalo. That is actually the longest stint he has had with any team since he's gotten into the league in 2005. I don't know if he spent more than 2 years with any other team, but people still remember that 6-year, $60 million contract the late Ralph Wilson gave Ryan when he was here. He really thought he was going to be the franchise quarterback. That did not work out. What was the feeling and response by the media and the fans when Ryan was signed in the offseason?
There was excitement. There were people that were excited. I think everybody realized that it was a Band-Aid, a short-term fix, and, you know, at least when he was signed, there was so much excitement about this defense that, hey, you know, if the defense is that good, maybe Fitz will be all they need. But now, Fitz is out with a hip injury, and the defense doesn't look like they can stop anybody. So the conversation has shifted pretty significantly.
There seems to be this groundswell from the Washington football fan base and even the national media when Washington's been on, you know, primetime games. This Taylor Heinicke story, it's this underdog, almost Kurt Warner-like. He's been in some quarterback rooms. He's been cut. He's not really been ever given a chance to be a starter. He was a week away from finishing up his LinkedIn page and getting out of football. Then he has a pretty good performance against Tampa Bay in the playoffs on a national scene. He helps the team come back on Monday Night Football against the New York Giants. Even if Fitzpatrick was healthy, it seems to me that Taylor's got this Kurt Warner, Doug Flutie, Nick Foles kind of underdog story that people are really rallying behind.
I mean, there are a lot of fans that didn't want him to sign Fitz, that just wanted it to be Heinicke's job going into training camp. I think because Fitz and Heinicke handled it so well, everybody was cool. Not everybody. There was still a camp that wanted Heinicke. I think, you know, if Fitz had had a few games where he struggled, the calls for Heinicke would have gotten significant. I think, and who knows what will happen, right? Because the problem with Heinicke is when he's gotten chances, he's gotten hurt also.
Right.
But Fitz's injury has been reported to probably be 2 months. So say he's available to come back in November. If Heinicke's playing well, Heinicke keeps the job for sure. If Heinicke has this team, I don't know what that would be, 5-3, and he's playing pretty well, I don't think they'd go back to Fitz.
I know it's still a little early, but what does the Washington Redskins injury report look like going into this Buffalo game?
Well, I mean, the most significant injury is Fitz, and then Washington also signed Curtis Samuel in the offseason to be like a stud receiver for them, and he's on the IR. So those are the most significant injuries, but they didn't occur last week. And honestly, their injury report's pretty clean. Antonio Gibson was dealing with a little bit of a shoulder issue before the Giants game, but he played that whole game and seemed fine. We probably won't get an official injury report until tomorrow, but I don't expect to see... Oh, Matt Ioannidis, forgive me. Matt Ioannidis, defensive lineman, that's a good pass rusher, came out of the Giants game but then went back in but did not practice today. Today is Tuesday. That could just be precautionary. We'll find out. Rivera hates giving injury information, so unless you're back-channel sourcing it, you very rarely get a real answer on that.
The old Bill Belichick approach to talking about injuries on the football team. If all things were equal, they were both healthy, if Ron asked you, Taylor Heinicke or Ryan Fitzpatrick, who would you give the nod to?
Heinicke, honestly. He's more mobile. He can get downfield a little bit. And he just plays football on a super intuitive level. And not that Fitz doesn't, but I mean, I wrote a column earlier last week. Heinicke has some intangible quality that is, I don't know, man. It's pretty remarkable. And I just think if he can stay, Bemidge, my co-host, firmly believes that once there's enough tape on him, that kind of the magic pumpkin will turn back into a pumpkin or whatever the hell that phrase is.
Right.
That the ride will end. And I just don't know that I see. I think the kid has something. I really do.
Most teams have a window of success depending on their free agencies and the contracts and their draft picks. Washington has some great guys on the defensive side of the ball. One of the best young receivers in the league with McLaurin. They just have not been able to put a quarterback in place. They have struggled. Dwayne Haskins flamed out. RG3 did not work out. Kirk Cousins was given a lot of money, couldn't get the team to the next level. Do you think there is a window of time that Ron has to get it right with a quarterback, whether in a draft or free agency, for this team to get to the next level with the talent they have before starting to lose some of these guys? Or can Heinicke fit in, be a game manager, don't lose the game for us, you don't have to win it, let's rely on our defense, and that's how the Redskins are going to do this? Or Heinicke's just a quick fix?
Sure. I mean, absolutely, but I don't remember all the names like I'm sure you do, but between Jim Kelly and Josh Allen, Buffalo largely had nothing, right, at
yeah.
the position?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Now, Washington's had nothing for 30 years.
Right.
I mean, you talked about Joe Theismann earlier. That's probably the last consistent stud quarterback they had. You know, Mark Rippon popped and Doug Williams popped, yep. But those guys were for right. shorter periods of time. Yep. At some point, Washington has to address the quarterback position. Yep. Maybe, so, I mean, everybody comes up with their comps, and the crazy stuff is Kurt Warner. I think that's out of this world. But people, you know, will say Tony Romo or Jeff Garcia, guys that were unheralded, undrafted, that kind of grinded and emerged to have really good NFL careers. I think Heinicke could be a Jeff Garcia, a guy that ends up being a really good player for you, maybe isn't the answer, but stabilizes that quarterback position for a bit. And honestly, I can't – this will be his first road game in the NFL, and I know that Bills crowd will be going nuts. I can't wait to see what he does up there.
On the phone with us, J.P. Finley, host of B. Mitch and Finley on 106.7 FM, The Fan in D.C. from 10 to 2. He is also host of the Washington Football Podcast and works for NBC Sports Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at JP Finley NBCS. Great foul. So you talked about the defense, and I was listening to you and Brian Mitchell. You guys have been disappointed, as others in the media, on that defense and how they perform Monday night against the Giants. And even Ron has been critical of the defense. What is it? Seems surprising, because that's really kind of where, coming into the season, it seemed Washington was going to hang their hat was on their defense.
They've been bad, dude. Nobody, I mean, they've given up 800 yards of offense. They're 24th in the league. They've been bad. And one thing I cautioned throughout the summer was, when Washington got hot last year and their defense really started to dominate, they were playing a bunch of terrible quarterbacks. They were playing backups and third stringers. They beat guys like Ben DiNucci and Nick Mullins. And I mean, they might have lost to the Eagles if they hadn't benched Jalen Hurts and brought in Nate Sudfeld.
Right.
So they have to prove it against good competition. Daniel Jones just looked like Kyler Murray against them last week. So Josh Allen, I know he hasn't looked great yet. This could be his get right game. Otherwise, Washington finally puts it together.
Has there been really any explanation? Is it scheme? It's not injury, as you said. Their injury report is pretty clean. Is it that, you know, I know some people are saying three preseason games and the guys are playing less in the preseason, and so they're a little slower to come around. Has there been any real great explanation as to why they have not got out of the starting blocks fast?
The best explanation we've gotten is that guys are being undisciplined and not committing to the scheme. Ron, in an interview with me, said the words, the guys are playing almost immature, which I thought that really stood out.
Real quickly, just scout the Washington Redskins for us. What is one aspect you think the Bills might be able to really take advantage of?
Washington's secondary has looked very beatable to the deep ball. And I think Steph Diggs is a huge advantage.
How do you see the NFC East unfolding?
The Cowboys look, I think, pretty clear ahead of everybody else, especially if their defense can play as well as they did against the Chargers. And that offense is just so explosive. I still think Washington's the second-best team. I don't know. I think the Eagles have a good defense. They just lost Brandon Graham. I don't know how much I trust Jalen Hurts. The Giants, to me, are a bit of an enigma. They've got some talent. They just don't seem to have it together.
Yeah.
So I still think it'll come down to Washington and the Cowboys, with probably the Cowboys ahead.
I know it's still early. Do you have a final score prediction for Sunday?
It's hard to see a path where the Bills don't win. I think Washington can maybe cover.
And last I looked, the Bills were a 9-point favorite. JP, thanks so much. Continued success. We appreciate you coming on.
All right, man. Thank you very much. You guys take care.
All right. There you go. JP Finley, co-host of the B. Mitch and Finley Show on WJFK 106.7 The Fan. He is also the host of the Washington Football Talk podcast, and he works for NBC Sports. You can follow him on Twitter at JP Finley NBCS. And don't forget, you can get in contact with us by leaving a voicemail or sending a text to 607-252-4BMT. That's 252-4268. It's the Washington football team at the Buffalo Bills. Sunday, pregame at 11 a.m., kickoff at 1 on this Buffalo Bills Radio Network affiliate.